I am Valentin Fuster for Jack, issue of April the 14th of 2020. Today in Jack, we have a Jack Council perspective with the title of Atrial Fibrillation, an excellent document. Such document is sponsored by the American College of Cardiology Electrophysiology Section Leadership Council, and the first author is Dr. Mina Chung from the Cleveland Clinic, and the last and corresponding author is Dr. Danjujaya Lakireddy from the Kansas City Heart Rhythm Institute and Research Foundation. Our summary will entail 5 sections. Section number 1, epidemiology and risk factors. Section number 2, atrial fibrillation pathophysiology and gaps for future studies. Section number 3, atrial fibrillation and stroke, complexities of prediction, diagnosis, and prevention. Section number 4 is about treatment of atrial fibrillation. And section number 5, future directions. Let's begin with section number 1, epidemiology and risk factors of atrial fibrillation. 3 questions are being addressed: general incidence and prevalence, risk factors for atrial fibrillation, and impact of atrial fibrillation on outcomes and economics. About the general incidence and prevalence, atrial fibrillation affects about 33 million people worldwide and more than 3 million in the United States. It is astonishing, but it is predicted by 2030 that the prevalence of atrial fibrillation in the United States will be of about 12 million people. This means a progressive increase in yearly incidence from 1.2 to 2.6 million people. About risk factors and perhaps triggers for atrial fibrillation are many. Let me mention the most common ones: obesity, diabetes, sleep apnea, excessive alcohol, most importantly, older age, and in addition, other factors are hypertension, coronary artery disease, valvular heart disease, heart failure, cardiomyopathy, extreme exertion, and genetically driven family history. What about impact of atrial fibrillation on outcomes and economics? In terms of impact, atrial fibrillation is a major risk factor for new onset heart failure with reduced or preserved ejection fraction, stroke, dementia, and mortality. And of course, we can add that the quality of life is significantly affected in a number of cases. In terms of economic impact, it has been suggested about 15 years ago that hospitalization costs for non-valvular atrial fibrillation in the United States was $6.5 billion, outpatient costs $1.5 billion, and drug costs $235 million. Currently, we have to add the costs of ablation therapies. So, summarizing this section of epidemiology and risk factors, atrial fibrillation is a cardiovascular entity that is significantly on the rise. And now, section number 2, atrial fibrillation pathophysiology and gaps for future study. 7 aspects, 7 comments. First aspect, triggers, rotors, and substrates for atrial fibrillation. First of all, achieving electrical isolation of triggers arising from the pulmonary vein ostia or antra has become the cornerstone of atrial fibrillation ablation since the report by Heisegger et al. More than 20 years ago. In terms of ablation success, about 80% to 90% in lone paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. Then by follow other types of paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, and the lowest success rates for more persistent forms of atrial fibrillation or with a structural heart disease. Indeed, ablation strategies for persistent atrial fibrillation remain controversial, whether additional substrate ablation beyond pulmonary vein isolation should be performed at initial ablation remains under active study. The durability of pulmonary vein isolation by the ablation methodology has also been problematic, with a continuing incidence of late atrial fibrillation recurrence, not infrequent, for example, at about 5 years of follow-up. Again, such recurrences, I would say, are more frequent in the persistent forms of atrial fibrillation following ablation than in patients with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. This actually is one of the reasons by which early ablation, perhaps at the time that the patient has only paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, may be considered rather than later when the arrhythmia is more persistent. The second issue is atrial fibrillation as a manifestation of atrial myopathy. We all know at this time that atrial fibrillation may also represent a secondary manifestation of a progressive atrial cardiomyopathy and may help to explain why some stroke events in patients with implanted devices fail to demonstrate a temporal relationship to preceding atrial fibrillation episodes. Basically, a not contractile left atrium or left atrial appendix may lead to thromboembolism, even if the patient is on normal sinus rhythm. I have further comments about this issue later on. And here is the third issue about the pathophysiology of atrial fibrillation, role of atrial scar or fibrosis. As just mentioned, a cardiomyopathic left atrium, particularly with fibrotic tissue, may be the cause of atrial fibrillation, or on the other hand, atrial fibrillation may contribute to the development of such myopathic fibrotic left atrium. Whether atrial fibrillation is the cause or the consequence, in such myopathic progressive fibrotic left atrium, not only thromboembolism may take place during periods of sinus rhythm, but ablation, as we mentioned, is more difficult to be successful, since at this stage, atrial fibrillation may be persistent, with rhythm dysfunction in several zones other than in the pulmonary vein ostia alone. And here is the fourth issue about pathophysiology of atrial fibrillation: inflammation, oxidative stress, and metabolic dysfunction. All three important mechanisms that may trigger atrial fibrillation or promote its maintenance. In fact, when we talk about inflammation, oxidative stress, or metabolic dysfunction, we are close to talking about diabetes, obesity, conventional and human immunodeficiency viruses, as well as atrial fibrillation after cardiac surgery, all of these clinical entities being well known to be associated with atrial fibrillation. And here is issue number five: abnormal proteostasis. On one hand, we are talking about the deposition of protein aggregates such as amyloid, this contributing to atrial fibrillation with the associated myopathy. But on the other hand, we are also talking about heat shock proteins, which play a protective role in the heart, mitigating protein aggregation and the negative remodeling effects of atrial fibrillation. Can we enhance such protective mechanism? Studies are ongoing. Issue number 6, neural mechanisms. We know about patients with autonomic nervous system dysfunction, those that with excitement, stimulants, vagal stimulation, or sick sinus syndrome, easily derive into atrial fibrillation. Also, in some of these cases and others, sympathetic enhancement, such as with ventricular pacing or rapid atrial pacing, may also be conducive to atrial fibrillation. And here is the final issue to be addressed in terms of pathophysiological pathways in atrial fibrillation, and these are genetics. First of all, genetic abnormalities and channelopathies have been associated with familial atrial fibrillation. But more specifically, there is a confirmation by genome-wide association studies that there are at least 100 loci associated with atrial fibrillation risk, with the top most important mutations having been identified in the chromosome 4q25 near the PITX2 gene, which in such abnormal circumstance may affect the pulmonary vein formation as well as the suppression of a normal sinus rhythm program. So in conclusion, in this section number 2, we discuss 7 issues or 7 atrial fibrillation pathways that require future studies. And here is section number 3, atrial fibrillation and stroke, complexities of prediction, diagnosis, and prevention. Here we have 5 issues or items for discussion. Here are the 5 topics: prediction of risk for atrial fibrillation, prediction of stroke and bleeding risks, screening and monitoring in the detection of atrial fibrillation and thromboembolic implications, temporal relationship between atrial myopathy, atrial fibrillation, and thromboembolism, and finally, the issue number 5, strategies for primary and secondary prevention of atrial fibrillation. First, prediction of risk for atrial fibrillation. 4 possibilities have been studied in terms of prediction: a CHA2DS2-VASc score equal or more than 3, an increased echocardiographic left atrial diameter, frequent atrial ectopy, an extensive late gadolinium enhancement equal or more than 30% of the left atrial wall enhanced in terms of fibrotic tissue. We are all familiarized with the first 3 predicting tools. Here is the second item: prediction of stroke and bleeding risks. So, prediction of thromboembolic risk from atrial fibrillation coupled with prediction scores for bleeding risk from anticoagulation forms the basis of anticoagulation strategies to reduce stroke risk in atrial fibrillation patients. Just a comment about 3 items here. The first, about CHA2DS2-VASc score. Reasonable good sensitivity and specificity for those cases for low or intermediate risk. But those at high risk, the specificity is not good. Why? Because those patients may have thromboembolic or thrombotic events unrelated to atrial fibrillation. What about bleeding? The HAS bled score. Its best predictive ability is for clinically relevant bleeding, which is what we want. But interestingly, and this is the third item, Various biomarkers, specifically N-terminal fragment B-type natriuretic peptide and high-sensitive cardiac troponin, independently have been well associated with risk of a stroke in atrial fibrillation. But most importantly, when combined with age and the clinical history of the patient, this specific biomarker approach is superior to the CHA2DS2-PASC in terms of prediction of a stroke. And this leads to the third item, a screening and monitoring in the detection of atrial fibrillation and thromboembolic implications. We can talk here about pulse taking, EKG screening, Apple watches, etc. But there is a key question here. What is the burden of atrial fibrillation that justifies the use of anticoagulation? Four findings are appropriate to comment on. First, daily atrial fibrillation burden of equal or more than 5.5 hours has a hazard ratio for thromboembolism of 2.2. Similarly, occasional episodes of atrial fibrillation that last more than 24 hours have a hazard ratio of 3.1. Third, episodes of atrial fibrillation that last more than 5 minutes but not too long have been associated with a risk of silent ischemic brain lesions. And here is the fourth consideration. The group of Kam et al. In the United Kingdom recommends consideration of anticoagulation in men with a CHA2DS2-PASC equal or more than 2 and in women with a CHA2DS2-PASC score of equal or more than 3 without history of ischemic stroke or clinical history of atrial fibrillation, but when episodes of more than 5 to 6 minutes are identified by any of the devices, and so recurrences. These are completely asymptomatic individuals. And here we have the fourth issue that we already mentioned a few times before, and is the temporal relationship between atrial myopathy, atrial fibrillation, and thromboembolism. Device data from the TRENDS study and information obtained from the AFFIRM and the RAISE studies, it appears that thromboembolism may occur certainly in patients with a history of atrial fibrillation, but the events happening during normal sinus rhythm, the myopathy that we mentioned before. Let me say at this time that in the near future, we are going to pay more and more attention by imaging about the structure and the function, about the volume and the function of the left atrium and the left atrial appendix. This will begin with patients perhaps with a history of atrial fibrillation, but probably this will go further. And finally, in this third section of complexities of prediction, diagnosis, and prevention of atrial fibrillation and stroke, the item number 5 is entitled Strategies for Primary and Secondary Prevention of Atrial Fibrillation. First, going back to section number 1, on epidemiology and risk factors, we mention a number of lifestyle and risk factors that could be modified, and this should be our emphasis in the prevention of atrial fibrillation. Remember, we talk about obesity, smoking, alcohol consumption, psychological stress, hypertension, obstructive sleep apnea, and hyperlipidemia. We know how to address these conditions, but it seems that when we see a patient with atrial fibrillation, the first thought is about drugs, or rather about ablation, but not about these important triggers, which is what I always try to teach the medical students, the residents and the fellows, that this should be the first line of thought. The possible etiology of this condition that could be manageable in terms of prevention. But now let's recall section number 2, different molecular pathways that could contribute to atrial fibrillation. We talk about inflammation, oxidative stress, metabolic dysfunction, fibrosis, and proteostasis. Thus far, very little can be done to counteract the molecular basis of such pathways, although we should maintain our hopes for the future. And if you are very optimistic, we can even talk about atrial fibrillation gene delivery. And this leads me to section number 4, treatment of atrial fibrillation. In regard to this section, I would like to refer you to the ACC virtual conference that just took place a week ago. And if you click on demand, is my presentation on atrial fibrillation, addressing 21 clinical challenges most related to treatment. Is a presentation, if I recall, of about 35 minutes. And this leads to the final section of this excellent document, Future Directions. There is no need for me to summarize all of the aspects that I mentioned, also included in the virtual presentation at the American College of Cardiology, but just to quote the last 5 lines of this important document today in JACC. A hope is that basic and translational research will lead to more effective and safe therapeutic options, including pharmacological and non-pharmacological ablative approaches. Close quotes. Unfortunately, we are talking about an endemic of the coronavirus, while when we talk about atrial fibrillation, we are moving towards a worldwide extension of a disease entity that about a few years ago was very much behind in the priorities of the cardiovascular system. Certainly, a very important entity today, which we could define as a tip of an iceberg of many conditions in its substrate that we can do something about it. Thank you.